How many of us have taken long road trips? Only a lot of us have, haven't we? And kids, on long road trips, road trip is where, flying, yes, but it's not quite as interesting. Road trips can be more interesting because there's things to see. For example, what sort of car games do you play while you're trying to pass away the hours?
Are we there yet?
Besides the are we there yet?
I read.
You read.
Is it
electronic
games?
Electronic
games? Yeah. What's it called?
Need for Speed.
Need for Speed, oh yeah.
Is it electronic games?
You like to watch the scenery, yeah.
When I was a kid, we had to look for license plates.
Yeah, you look for license plates, you look for play games involving road signs. No, you look for road signs. Maybe you try to go from A to Z, or Z to A, or try to find all the letters. Try to see how many different colors of signs you can find, and so forth and so on. Now, what's the purpose of road signs?
Where you're at and where you're going.
Well, yeah, the person wrote to give us information. Some of us tell us, what road we're on, if we go so far, where we might be.
Also, it tells you when you missed your turn, then you got to run another 20 miles.
Yeah, when you miss your turn and the next exit is 20 miles down, right?
Well, how do we call it? That progress shape time.
Wisdom.
They have little signs about this square, and they have two or three words on them, and then about every 500 feet they have another sign, and you read them as you go down the road.
Oh, okay.
At the very end it says Wall Drug, North Dakota, and they are very classic. They've been around for a decade. And also, are you going to talk about Lady Bruce?
No.
She passed away yesterday.
Yes.
She was the one that actually encouraged the United States to decrease the number of road signs because we were being cluttered with
Yeah, there are those advertisements too. They're part of road signs, billboards and things. Oh, there's a nice little stag out there. Yeah, everyone, pause, look out the window.
Let's be hungry.
They tell you kind of maybe what's coming up ahead that you might be interested in.
Yeah.
Or not. Gasolines, But do road signs, do they usually tell you exactly where your destination is located? They give you kind of a general idea of where your destination could be located, but they don't tell you you are here. Nor do they tell you what your destination looks like, do they? If you're going to, say, your grandma's house somewhere 100 miles, do the road signs tell you exactly where it is or exactly what it might look like? No. And sometimes we come across road signs that have smaller print under them. Maybe it says, this exit is only open during parts of the year, or this road is only open during parts of the year. Now, would it be absurd to make following the signs our destination? These signs are so interesting that we'll just keep going to see what sign is next on the road. Maybe there's a... or let's say, you see a sign that says the particular city, let's say Los Angeles is 5 miles away. And so you go, you look at the little trip meter and say, well, 5 miles, this must be Los Angeles. Well, it doesn't look like Los Angeles because usually Los Angeles city limits is, you know, not exactly where the city is. And so, well, you know, it doesn't look like it. It doesn't look like Los Angeles, so let's build a city here. That's, and we'll make Los Angeles right here. It's kind of absurd to do that, wouldn't it? Or again, missing the fine print that may be on some of these signs, and in the middle of winter, taking a road up the mountain saying, you know, you can get past it, and discover that, well, the sign said so, didn't it? Nope, you maybe forgot to read the little fine print. Well, it's the point I'm getting at here is that it's a little bit of what, well, the story of feeding the 5,000. This is John chapter 6. And verse 2. Well, a huge crowd kept following Jesus wherever he went because they saw his miraculous signs as he healed the sick. And the crowd just keep following the signs. What they were doing. And at the end of the story, towards the end of the story, in verse 14, when the people saw him do this miraculous sign, they exclaimed, surely he is the prophet we have been expecting. These people were the crowd. They were following the signs. But as we'll see, sometimes, or the sign isn't the destination. Jesus was showing these signs, but he was trying to get the people to look at him instead of the signs, but the people were so fascinated by the signs that they kept following them. Kind of like, you know, if you're taking a road trip, you're so fascinated by following the signs that you keep going and going and going, and you never get to the destination. And so,
mispronouncing the sign, like, we were going to Tucson, and we saw these signs for Tuscan. And we kept going on and on. Or you might get mixed up with the city and go through Cedar Rapids and go to Cedar Falls and be in the wrong city.
That's
at 1 in the morning.
Entirely possible. If you misunderstand the signs, you could end up in the wrong place. And it seems to me that maybe that's one of the things that this story is bringing out. That signs by themselves don't give us the whole story. And so, let's look at the story again. And we all probably know the story where Jesus is up on the hill and the crowd begins to come to him. And he begins teaching, he's healing. And towards the end of the day, they apparently have gone the whole day without food, or so it seems, and so Jesus wants to give these people food. But anyway, let's start with verse 1 of John chapter 6. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. This is the only miracle that's recorded in all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so from that, we could gather that there's something pretty important about this because it's stuck in the minds of all these people, either the people that told the writers of these Gospels or the writers themselves who were there. Where this happened was near Bethsaida. We read that in Luke 9:10, in Luke's account of this same story. And from John 1, verse 44, we learn that Bethsaida is Philip's hometown, and this becomes important a few more verses down. After this time, between chapters 5 and chapter 6 of John, about a year and a half passed by. John skips the entire, shall we say, a whole year of Jesus' ministry. The other Gospels record many of the things that happened during that time, but John really doesn't find it apparently. I guess the other gospel writers' recollections and recording was sufficient, that John didn't have to add other details here. And so we get to verse 2, and a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Now, it's a familiar theme by now, John's theme of superficial faith versus genuine faith. Again, here he's saying these people were following Jesus not because of who Jesus was, but because of what Jesus was doing to benefit them. An example of superficial faith. We also could see that maybe John is giving us a kind of a double meaning, something that he likes to do in his writing. Because they saw the signs that he was doing. Jesus was healing the sick. The last two signs had to do with healing. And so Jesus was continuing that. And healing, as we understood, has to do with salvation. It's not merely physical healing that Jesus wants to accomplish in people. He wants to heal us, both physically and spiritually. And so I think John is telling us that Jesus was trying to get the people's attention that, you know, through the physical healings that he was doing, he was trying to get the people to go deeper, to understand their need for physical healing, for spiritual healing, rather, that they were sick spiritually and they needed spiritual healing. Feeding the 5,000, this story is the height of Jesus' popularity. Crowds are following. 5,000 men is what's recorded. Have any idea how many people that is? What's the population of Petersburg? About 3,000.
It's probably about 6,000 right now.
Okay, yeah. Well, but 3,000. 3,000 is the population, and 5,000 was just the men. It could have been, what? So the crowd that gathered around Jesus could have been as much as 20,000. Yeah. Is there any place on this island where you could fit that many people? All in one place? Now, 20,000 people, it's hard to imagine. The right auditorium seats, I think it's like 300, isn't it? I think it's about 300. And so we're talking, five, 50, 60, 70 of that. Yeah. That's a lot of people. It's the height of Jesus' popularity. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. The account in Mark gives us an insight into why Jesus did this. He wanted to be alone. Well, he's been ministering to the people, and Jesus wanted to be alone with his disciples so that he could teach his disciples. But Jesus was not to be left alone. Verse 4, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Another reason why there were so many people near Jerusalem. Why there were so many people traveling through. Because Passover was the one feast where the Jews would come from all over the Roman Empire to celebrate. And so people's expectations of a deliverer like Moses was heightened during this time. Now they look back to the original Passover where they were delivered from the slavery in Egypt. In verse 5, Jesus lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, remember Philip? Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? Jesus said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip, as a local, Jesus asks him, so, where can we buy some bread? These people have gone a whole day without being able to go get some food. So where can we buy some food? Where can we buy some bread for them? What I find interesting is that a similar imagery, and at least I think it's similar imagery, is found in John chapter 4, verses 27 through 35. This is the woman at the well, the story of the woman at the well. Now, just then his disciples came back. They were shocked to find him talking to a woman, but none of them had the nerve to ask, "What do you want with her, or why are you talking to her?" The woman left her water jar beside the well and ran back to the village, telling everyone, "Come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could he possibly be the Messiah?" So the people came streaming from the village to see him. And meanwhile, the disciples were urging Jesus, "Rabbi, eat something." But Jesus replied, "I have a kind of food you know nothing about." "Did someone bring him food while we were gone?" the disciples asked each other. Then Jesus explained, "My nourishment comes from doing the will of God who sent me and from finishing his work. You know the saying, 4 months between planting and harvest, but I say, wake up and look around. The fields are already ripe for harvest. The harvesters are," and so on. But just a few chapters back, we have the same kind of imagery of people coming and of food, of people being hungry, in this case, not physically, but spiritually. And I wonder, did John place these stories close together to make some kind of a point there? And I just wonder. But the result is very different. In the case of the woman at the well, the whole village of Sychar comes to believe in Jesus as not just a wonder worker, but as the Messiah, the Savior. Whereas, as we later find out in the story of feeding the 5,000, you know, most of the people don't. They don't believe. So is John contrasting the Samaritans with the Galileans? I also find it interesting what Jesus asks Philip here. Where are we to buy bread? And in verse 7, Philip answers, "We don't have enough money." Jesus asks where, Philip answers the question how. Philip answers the question Jesus didn't ask. Then I also wonder, now we go back into Isaiah 55, verses 1 to 3, which is the scripture reading for this morning. Did Jesus have this in mind when he asked the question, where are we to buy bread? Isaiah 55, verses 1 to 3. "If anyone thirsty, come and drink. Even if you have no money, come, take your choice of wine or milk. It's all free. Why spend your money on food that does not give you strength? Why pay for food that does you no good? Listen to me, and you will eat what is good. You will enjoy the finest food. Come to me with your ears wide open. Listen, and you will find life. I will make an everlasting covenant with you. I will give you all the unfailing love I promised to David." Many of the stories of Jesus recorded in John are what's called acted parables. And so, I wonder, was John and Jesus trying to allude to the fact that, here is the provider. There's a provider of spiritual food. That through his miracle, Jesus was trying to bring attention to the fact that here was someone who is going to fulfill the promises of Isaiah 55. One of our retired seminary professors notes that this is an instance where it was totally unnecessary for Jesus to provide the food. He could have sent the people home. They weren't that far away from civilization. In some of the other Gospels, there's another feeding, a feeding of the 4,000 that's recorded, but in that case, the people had actually gone for 3 days without any food. And in that case, providing the food was necessary, but in the feeding of the 5,000 story, the suggestion is that it really was an unnecessary miracle. So why did Jesus do it? And so, you know, we have this Philip's answer to Jesus, 200 denarii, or it comes out to about eight months of an average laborer's pay. So it's 200 denarii would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little. And then Mark records Jesus asking the disciples to find out, well, how much bread is available. And then in John 6:8, Andrew comes back and says to him, here's a boy who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they for so many? You know, as I was thinking about this, what's amazing is that of, let's say, 15,000, 20,000 people, is this the only food that they had? 5 loaves and 2 fish, or, so, you know, where was all the rest of the food? What was John trying to tell us here, to emphasize here? Was there really no other food, or did everyone else who had any food, you know, just thinking only of themselves? I wonder. And then Jesus said, have the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. And this brings back the image of Psalm 23, the famous shepherd psalm. The Lord is my shepherd. I have all that I need. He lets me rest in green meadows. He leads me beside peaceful streams. He renews my strength. He guides me along right paths, bringing honor to his name. Even when I walk through the darkest valley, I will not be afraid, for you are close beside me. Your rod and your staff protect and comfort me. You prepare a feast for me in the presence of my enemies. You honor me by anointing my head with oil. My cup overflows with blessings. Surely your goodness and unfailing love will pursue me all the days of my life, and I will live in the house of the Lord forever. Did Jesus have this in mind when he said, when he looked around and said, have the people sit down? Was he trying to make the point that I am the good shepherd of Psalm 23? No, I'm here to lead you. I'm here to provide for you. And then, in verse 11 of John 6 now, Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. I'm just curious now. I wonder what all the people who had food but kept it to themselves think when this happened. This also appears to be kind of an allusion to the Last Supper. And Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them. The Lord's Supper, the Last Supper, is a picnic. At least in this case. In fact, you can see a similar imagery in the last chapter of John 21, Jesus by the sea again. And again, he picks up bread and distributes it. Again, it's a picnic by the lake. And then verse 12, and when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. And again, I go back to Isaiah 55. Towards the end of that chapter, verses 10 and 11, No, the rain and snow come down from the heavens and stay on the ground to water the earth. They cause the rain to grow, producing seed for the farmer and bread for the hungry. It is the same with my word. I send it out, and it always produces fruit. It will accomplish all I want it to, and it will prosper everywhere I send it. There's a lot of similarities between the story of feeding the 5,000 in Isaiah 55. And it seems more than just a coincidence. So in verse 13, the disciples, they gather up all the leftovers and fill 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 15 through 18, talk about this prophet that was promised, that the people had recognized. This is Deuteronomy reading now from verse 15. Moses continued, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your fellow Israelites. You must listen to him. For this is what you yourselves requested of the Lord your God when you were assembled at Mount Sinai. You said, 'Don't let us hear the voice of the Lord our God anymore, or see this blazing fire, for we will die.' Then the Lord said to me, 'What they have said is right. I will raise up a prophet like you from among their fellow Israelites. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell the people everything I command him.'" So the people saw the signs, and they connected it with the right prophecy. And they decided to make Jesus king. Jesus, perceiving that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Mark's recollection, or Mark's recording of this account, Mark probably listened to Peter, so it's Peter's recollection recorded by Mark, implies that everyone, including Jesus' disciples, were scheming to make Jesus king. They understood the prophecy, they interpreted it, and saw the right person, but they missed the actual message. Even Jesus' disciples, who had been with Jesus now for 2.5 years. And this perhaps was the greatest temptation that Jesus faced. Jesus could have taken up the people on their, you know, what they wanted. And Jesus could have had the kingdom without facing rejection, without facing suffering, without going through death. He could have made the Jewish nation great again. But instead, he compels his disciples to go. He dismisses the crowd, and he goes back up on the mountain to be alone with himself, to be by himself, to pray. Now, the crowd, they saw the signs. They saw the healings. They personally experienced the feeding. The crowd even recognized the object, the person, to whom the signs pointed. They put this together with the past prophecies about the promised prophet. But the crowd had some preconceived ideas about what the signs meant and where they would lead. They thought this prophet would be just like Moses, delivering them from political bondage. The crowd thought they knew what the next sign would look like or should look like, and so they tried to force Jesus into a political and military leader. They tried to put Jesus into a box of their own creation. The crowd missed or chose to ignore the finer print in the signs. Even the disciples thought they were doing the right thing in trying to force Jesus to be king. Most of the crowd and many of the disciples, well, there were many other disciples besides the 12 present, many of the crowd and many of the disciples, the very next day, would no longer believe in Jesus. We'll read that towards the end of John 6. Jesus fails to fit the end time sequence of signs that the crowd thought he should fit. And so they stopped believing. And I wonder, could we fall into similar traps that the crowd for whom Jesus miraculously provided food fell into? As Adventists, are we in some particular way susceptible to that, I wonder? Now, we were founded on signs. We were founded on prophecies. It's our traditional emphasis on evangelism. We even have a publication called Signs of the Times. I've known members that believe very strongly in certain ordering of events, how those things will happen. They tell me they know precisely how Revelation is going to play out. But it's not just Adventists, though. There are many Christians who have laid out a very detailed scenario of how Revelation is supposed to play out. One of the examples could be the Left Behind novels. There are many Christians, including Adventists, who believe in helping the signs to come about. But what if the sequence of signs are different when they do come about? What if some of them don't seem to come? Or what if some of them end up looking quite different than what we may expect? Why does God give signs to us? I think, there's probably a whole lot of reasons, but some of them. To confirm and grow existing faith in Him. Perhaps He came to gain the attention of those who are searching for Him. And to show that there is still a living God. The problem seems to occur when people place the signs above the giver of signs. There's a danger that the pursuit of signs then becomes the goal. There's a danger that people begin to think that they know the signs better than God does. There's a danger that they may lead others astray. And there's a danger that because they put so much faith in the signs instead of the giver of signs, that their faith in God may ultimately fail when expectations aren't met. So, don't fall into the trap of getting so caught up with the signs that we lose focus on the one, on Jesus, to whom the signs point. It should serve us as a warning to us that many who have seen and experienced Jesus' signs firsthand, and even recognized Him to be the predicted prophet, they ultimately failed to believe in Him when He failed to fit their beliefs regarding the signs. And so, may we never place beliefs about and expectations and desires for signs above the one who gives the signs. Now let God be God. And let us be flexible about how God chooses to manifest Himself and His works in this world.